Welcome, 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 dear listeners, to LNL. First up tonight, MH370 and Malaysian Society. I'll be introducing you shortly to our two guests, Anwar Ibrahim, opposition leader of Malaysia. He was Deputy Prime Minister from 93 to 98, and this is his third appearance, at least his third appearance on the programme. Last year, we talked about the demonstrations calling for changes to Malaysia's voting system, far and away the largest Malaysia had ever seen, and Anwar called them rather optimistically the Malaysian Spring. For me, even more memorable, however, was an hour we spent together in Brisbane discussing the plays of Shakespeare. Quite extraordinary story, in that his solace and companion during his years of solitary confinement were Shakespeare's plays, and he's become an absolute star scholar of Shakespeare's contributions to humanity and sanity. Bridget Welsh is joining us. Bridget is Associate Professor of Political Science at Singapore Management University, and God help us, she's edited so many books, is writing about a dozen others, and she's currently studying women in politics in Southeast Asia and has ongoing projects examining Islamist parties, vigilante violence in Indonesia and political conditions in Burma. So between the two of them, we should be able to find out a lot of things we need to know. And then there'll be a complete change of focus, and we shall zoom in on that tiniest of creatures, the mosquito. It's a revisit to a story that we taped some time ago, but it was an immensely popular one. Now, there's been new developments on the missing flight. Prime Minister Abbott told Parliament that a couple of objects spotted in the Indian Ocean by Australian aircrafts could possibly be connected to the search operation. I think, in fact, they were spotted by satellite. Meanwhile, in Malaysia, the disappearance of the flight has become a defining moment for the country's Prime Minister. Of course, this is not the first time leaders have found it difficult to deal with a crisis. Last year, the President of the Philippines was criticised for taking his own time to visit the victims of a typhoon. And of course, we vividly recall President George W. Bush overlooking, literally, the flooding of New Orleans and continuing his vacation. But you can't really compare these situations to how Malaysian leaders are reacting to the disappearance of flight MH370, because since independence, Malaysian politicians have told their people what they need to know on their terms. And this lack of accountability, it seems, filters down to the laws of the country, to press freedom, and to state-owned organisations like Malaysian Airlines. So joining me on the phone from KL, Anwar Ibrahim, and in the BBC studio is Bridget Welsh. This is in Singapore. First of all, Bridget, the wreckage sightings are being described as very credible. What's the latest you're hearing?
The same as you, that we're looking at a possibility of finding the plane. And this is, if it is true, it's going to be wonderful news and help us to bring closure to what's been going on for now almost 2 weeks.
Well, finding the wreckage won't solve the mystery in the short term, but yes, that's absolutely correct. And what would you describe the feeling on the ground in Malaysia in the last couple of weeks? How's the public reacting to the bits of information filtering through?
Well, there is, of course, this sense of sadness prevailing all sectors of the community. It is a common scene to have people praying of various religious denominations, and that is, of course, very reassuring for a country like Malaysia. But after the events unravel, after a few days, and they become really disgruntled, in the manner the leadership has been rather opaque, have been releasing bits and pieces of information. In fact, what is most appalling is the reluctance to release the information caught from the radar. I'm familiar and privy to the type of radar being used called the Marconi, which is placed at the South China Sea, that has capacity to sight any flying objects right across to the Indian Ocean, because it covers the heart of the northern tip of our mainland Malaya. So these things have been arrival, and as you said, Philips, we are familiar with the how they deal with the compliant media, and now with the entire radar, international radar, focusing Malaysia, they are, I think, in lots of trouble.
And well, I'm going to pick you up on one point, and that is, to some extent, you seem to be describing a strengthening of community feeling facing the scale of the tragedy and the mystery.
Yes, because the last year or so, we have sensed this strong racist chants by elements associated with the ruling party and religious bigotry on the church issues, on the Bible. But now you sense at the public level, the popular people's level, you find there is this strong comradeship. I mean, as a Malay pilot, Chinese passengers, and some other nationalities. I mean, you sense that the prayer covers all. I've attended some, I've heard many, and I joined some of these prayers. They all pray for all, and this is very reassuring, as I said, Phillips, because the compartmentalization, racial profiling has been so clear and pervasive in the last year that now we see this sense of, togetherness.
There has, unfortunately, been an attempt to blame you for the crisis or the missing flight, hasn't there? Have you reacted to that publicly?
Yes, they have now officially denied. They say no one in the government actually did that. But we know now, we are privy that the fact that Daily Mail, that UK, that started this campaign, saying that this is a fanatical supporter of AMNO, of Anwar, and therefore there is a likelihood that he may be just disgusted by the ruling of the Court of Appeal to imprison me for 5 years and resulted to this. But I don't deny that I know him. But why we suggest that the ruling establishment is so totally involved? Because immediately the entire AMNO or government-supported bloggers and media played up the story.
Yeah.
MPs, government MPs actually questioned. We want the leader of the opposition to explain how is it that the foreign media is now implicating in this. And so I had to say, look, I know this man. It is grossly unjust to apportion the blame when there's no shred of evidence. This man have impeccable credentials as a professional pilot. He is a family man. His only sin, according to the ruling party, is because he's my supporter. He's committed to freedom and justice and democracy in Malaysia.
Well, of course, according to the regime, almost everything that goes wrong in Malaysia is your fault. Bridget, in spite of being a democracy, Malaysia's been governed by the same coalition since independence. An extraordinary fact in and of itself. And the coalition is known for its lack of transparency. Is this the first time that Malaysian leaders have been really seriously challenged?
From the perspective of the international community, yes. I think they've been really put under the spotlight. And I think in the first few days, you saw high levels of people of deer in the headlights dynamic, where they were not responding in a cohesive, in a clear, forthright manner. And that created a crisis of credibility that I think they're still dealing with now. But domestically, they've tasted a lot of challenges, and the problem has been that their responses tend to be a denial or a dismissal or using partisan type of attacks that don't really build credibility even within the society itself. One would have expected in a crisis like this that there would have been a rally around the leader effect. But in fact, while most Malaysians gave the Prime Minister the benefit of the doubt, especially in the first few days, you saw beginning a creeping in of a lot of questions and people looking at the government with a lot of suspect because of how they've been acting in the society domestically as well.
And while you were a part of the ruling coalition for many years, how would you have handled the situation if that was still the case, if it had happened, on your shift?
I would still give credit to many of our political leaders or professionals or civil servants who are competent or qualified to deal with the situation. We had an early experience, perhaps as far back as 75, dealing with the attack or hostage taking by the Japan Red Army of the embassies, a few embassies including US, Sweden, etc. We handled it brilliantly. And then we have smaller problems. But in this case, I think the failure of Prime Minister Najib to appear, to be seen to be hands-on, in fact, there's a standard joke here, the disappearance of the flight and the disappearance of the Prime Minister for the first 9 days. Then he reappeared only to give a statement refusing to entertain answers or questions. And then you should have appointed one competent either minister or senior official just to deal on a coherent, as Bridget, I think, rightly put it, because there are too many contradictions in it, or virtually every day. People can find fault in the various answers by the Civil Aviation Authority and Malaysian Airlines and the Inspector General of Police and, again, the Minister of Home Affairs and the Minister of Transport. And we can't have that. So you have actually lost credibility. The system is opaque and they can get away with the local scene, but I think they get hammering from the international media.
Now, to be fair, of course, it's such an unusual set of circumstances that any government anywhere could have been caught off guard. Bridget, Clive Kessler, University of New South Wales, has said that Najib's administration is sending the message to the people that the government will tell them what they need to know, when they need to know it and not before. That's the way they've acted for generations, but they are clearly starting to find out it doesn't work these days.
No question. I think we saw this very openly yesterday when the Chinese families came into the briefing. I think the people that have been the most traumatized by this are the families themselves. I mean, many of the briefings were held very late at night, and they are, you know, very rightly upset. But I think the international community is also concerned, because in this day and age, these issues raise very serious questions of security. It's had changed the whole dynamic and parameters of looking at issues of security in the context of Asia. We're now looking at the sky instead of the sea. And it may be a tectonic shift in these particular issues. And that's why it is important for us to learn the right lessons and to recognize that this is something that is not just about Malaysia, it's about the world.
I must also point out to the listener that social media has exploded in recent years. If you go back to New Orleans, Bush didn't really have to contend with that to any great extent. But these days, of course, it sends things spiraling out of control. This is a big help to you, social media, isn't it, Anwar?
Yes, in the absence of any media access here. For example, I told you, Phillips, that during the last elections, I don't even get 1 minute of air time. So I'm totally dependent on the social media. But here, I think, as Bridget said, the general public has become growingly cynical the type of information being released. You are right, Philip, that it is unprecedented. So they can be excused for the first 1 or 2 days. But you can't excuse them when there's a series of contradictions. You can't excuse them when the radar has the capacity to cite and they're still silent until today. I am appalled why, they have not offered any explanation why there is no explanation to the fact that the plane shifted from South China Sea towards the Indian Ocean. And then the Chinese, the Vietnamese, and international forces have to spend millions of dollars searching in the area where the Malaysian authorities knew from the beginning the plane was not there.
LNL on RN, and we're looking at how the disappearance of flight MH370 has exposed fundamental shortcomings in Malaysian society. And my guests are Dr. Anwar Ibrahim and Bridget Welsh. Now, Bridget, let's move on to the different layers of Malaysian society. We've touched briefly on the ethnicities and religious complexities. The elite, also known as the sons of the soil, govern the country. They're in control of most of the media, the government departments, and are the political beneficiaries, I guess, of a comparatively booming economy. Bridget, tell us about the sons of the soil.
Well, this policy of affirmative action was introduced in 1971 after the racial riots of 1969. And I think most scholars would agree that for about 20 years it had very profound and I think positive effects of enhancing the well-being of a lot of the communities, particularly the Malay community, because resources were spent in areas of education, in terms of employment generation, and helped to address some of the inequalities that were in the society. The problem is that as the policy evolved, it evolved in a way that didn't necessarily benefit those that really needed it the most. So people who actually had access to the government resources and access to political actors benefited more than those that didn't have access. And so you see very sharp divide among the Malay community, which are the predominantly the Pumiputras, along with the ethnic communities in the context of Borneo, which are a large number of different groups, including the Dayaks and Ibans. And they are actually highly, in East Malaysia, the level of poverty is the most concentrated and actually have not benefited. So you see disparity in the way the policy has actually been implemented and its effects. And there hasn't been fundamental reforms in the new economic policy in meaningful ways. And one of the problems of this elite type of orientation is that it's concentrated a lot of wealth among those who have been close access to political power. And this is where a lot of the concerns in Malaysia stem from questions of good governance and questions of corruption that are seen to be benefiting the policies that are benefiting those in power as opposed to the people at large.
And well, you were a son of the soil, I guess, weren't you, when you became dominant in Malaysian politics?
Yeah, I happen to be a Malay Bumiputra Muslim, so I qualify to be called son of the soil. And Philip, frankly, I did support when I was a student, and many years afterwards, this policy launched by the then Prime Minister, the father of the Tun Sri Najib, because the contention then was social mobility to handle the poor, marginalized Malay and Bumiputra community. And I would concede, yes, there has been tremendous positive results in terms of access to education and petty business. But now, I think the last 10, 15, 20 years, there's a growing criticism because this policy actually ends up enriching the few family members. Mahathir's son is a multi-billionaire, Najib's family. I mean, so all those associated family members of the ruling clique and their cronies are now billionaires using this same son of a soil logic. Yeah. Now, that is why since 2007, I launched this new program to dismantle this new economic policy, which I consider as obsolete, and to replace it with the Malaysian economic agenda. If at all you have affirmative action, which is required, then it has to be more transparent for the needy. Incidentally, there is a citizen report, shocking report published by the Center for Poverty at the University of Malaya that shows growing inequality. That at the rate things are going, then the state of the inequality between the Malay rural poor and the urban settlers, the richer community, has been relegated to almost at the same position as the late 70s. And this is shocking, to say the least.
Okay, this is LNL on RN, and let us remind you, dear listener, that ethnic Malays who make up half the population hold nearly all the top government positions and receive, as my distinguished guests point out, a host of government preferences. Now, while both Indonesia and the Philippines are not as wealthy as Malaysia, it seems, Bridget, they're much more in touch and more accountable with their publics. Is that how you see it?
Well, I think both countries, you know, have a democratic transitions in 1986 in the case of the Philippines and in 1998, 1999 in the context of Indonesia. So you've seen real changes of political power, and of course that has increased the issues of accountability. Well, there's been, I think, a significant move to reform Malaysia and democratization efforts on the part of civil society. We have not seen a transition of power in Malaysia. And in fact, we've seen quite the opposite. We've seen efforts to maintain themselves in power, and we saw that in the elections of last May. and we're seeing this in the cases involving opposition leaders. And this raises questions about the ability of people to be able to change their government in a peaceful manner, which most Malaysians want to do. And the majority voted for change. And I think this is something that is clearly differentiates Malaysia in the sense that its trajectory is one of basically against what most of its people want, as opposed to in the case of Indonesia and the Philippines. While there are clearly problems of governance and corruption and other issues in both those countries, you're still getting a lot higher level of accountability.
And while we've not mentioned gender, your daughter was on the program in March 2011, and she was raising the issue of women in Malaysian society. Any comment on this?
Well, I think compared to most developing countries or Muslim countries, I think we are doing reasonably well in terms of opportunities for our girls and women. But there's a long way to go because, say, for example, in the civil service, the avenues and opportunities for promotion is more limited. Even in the political sphere, we have a firm policy, for example, even in the party, to allow better access for women leadership. It is still a struggling effort, and I would concede that much more need to be done.
Bridget, how could crisis management have improved within both the government and the airline?
Well, I think there clearly was a coordination problem from the very beginning. It wasn't clear who is actually the spokesman in terms of the hierarchy, and there was too many voices in the very beginning. I think this has improved in the course of the few days. They've hired consultants and others to help them in this regard. I think the other thing has to do with the tone of how information was being shared. It was more defensive, and it didn't help to build a sense of confidence and credibility. And there wasn't the sense that it was actually it was of confidence, which in turn, confidence yields confidence. And I think this didn't happen in the very beginning. And you also had it, and this raised questions about issues of transparency and information sharing. And in fact, one of the problems is that most of the information was coming outside of the spokesmen from the government and the company. They were coming from the international media, which many of it was being repeated domestically in the domestic media outlets. So in fact, it was sensed that they were largely on the defensive as opposed to setting the tone and showing leadership. To give the Malaysian government credit, we've seen improvements over the period of time, but there still have been these same dynamics because the culture of maintaining in a more opaque and a more closed sharing of information runs very deep. And I think there isn't the sense that in order to build credibility, you have to be very honest and straightforward from the get-go.
I think we should make the point until this disappearance, Malaysian Airlines have had an excellent track record, haven't they, Anwar? They haven't suffered a major crash for nearly 15 years. They're a much improved outfit.
Yeah, both the engineering and the crew, I mean, generally I would give them accolades. I travel a lot, the Malaysian Airlines, gone through the report. The problem with the airline is, of course, the general management, ownership, and the issue of the controversial privatization that have led it to bleed till now. But I think when it comes to crew, staff, and the engineering sector, I have no issue with them. I've always been consistently in full of praise for them.
At the moment, the ownership of Qantas is a huge political issue in this country. Who actually owns the airline, Malaysian Airlines?
Now back to the government. It's always when you privatize, and you privatize at a loss, you bail out the big company, and this is the tradition set by Mahathir, bail out to the son of 2 billion ringgit. And the same tradition for Bas, you bail out the owner who privatized at a loss, given a golden handshake, and then the burden is now being placed to the government.
Okay. Now, Bridget, I want to take a look at what the disappearance of the flight means for relationships between Malaysia and China, given, of course, that 154 passengers were from China.
I think there are going to be very, quite significant effects in the region. I think, China has been very explicit in its criticism, in the sense that we've seen these attacks on the response, not on Malaysians per se, but on the Malaysian government and the Malaysian Airlines response across China and in the Chinese media. I expect that it will take some time to restore some of the bilateral relationships, because many of the Chinese families in particular have felt that they have not received the attention and information that they need, and this, of course, has had significant resonance. But I also think there's going to be shifts and changes in the region as a whole. The Malaysians largely have had to turn to American investigators, and I think in part, even though the Chinese were there, they were not necessarily able to provide the assistance that was needed in the areas of aviation and also in the scope of the questions of the search and rescue. So you saw the NSTB and the FAA and other investigative actors on the part of the U.S. come in, and of course Australia has been a very important player. And if, of course, they end up finding the plane within a day of taking responsibility over the particular area of the Indian Ocean, I think this will speak very highly of Australia's capacity to be able to respond. So I think we're looking at capacity issues in the relationships, and we're looking at kind of new security dynamics. I think we're going to see increased competition between the U.S. and China, in part because this is going to teach the lesson to the Chinese that they don't have as much security and control over the region as they thought. And I think this may give them a green light to be more active in the region.
Okay, we're out of time, but a final question to you, and if I might. I would have thought that what we're witnessing is going to shake up domestic politics in Malaysia by an order of magnitude at least, and it might help free up the system, which would be advantageous to your opposition.
Well, firstly, I want to point out to the victims that should be the major consideration, Phillips. But I think because the opaque system is under public or international scrutiny, I don't believe that the leadership could just go back to business as usual. Although I was in Parliament this morning, I've seen no sense of that among the political leadership of the ruling MPs. I am shocked, to say the least, that they're just carrying on saying the same thing, I mean, oblivious to the whole society and the whole world. So we are up for some major problems here.
We've got to wind it up. I thank you both very, very much. Thank you, Anwar Ibrahim, and thank you, Bridget Welsh. I found this a really fascinating discussion. LNL on RN, and after a little bit of music, we're not going to be looking at a missing plane. We're going to be looking at the mosquito.